ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The first generations of humans who lived in Australia knew it as a very different place. The climate was probably cooler and wetter. The land was mostly greener and less arid. And there were gigantic animals walking around like they owned the place. These animals looked somewhat like today's distinctly Australian species, just much bigger. Rhino-sized wombat creatures. Huge kangaroos with short faces that walked instead of hopped. And marsupial lions that could climb trees, grab their prey with a thumb claw, and maul their victims with teeth like shearing blades. If I'm honest, the childhood dinosaur fan in me finds all of this stuff very, very cool. And this is also true for Aaron Caymans. Aaron is a paleontologist and an expert in Australian megafauna based at Flinders University. And he can be seen in that outstanding two-part documentary series, Megafauna, on ABC iView. Aaron has travelled out to remote parts of South Australia, to the places where these creatures used to lumber around hundreds of thousands of years ago. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
You say in your bio that you are one of those, quote, annoying people who decided what they wanted to do at an early age. What age was that?
Well, when I was very young, maybe 4 or 5 years old, I can remember opening my grandfather's encyclopedia to the letter D, looking up dinosaurs, and really that was the first thing that sparked my imagination in the whole realm of paleontology. It was a two-page spread, black and white, and it had a range of it, you know, the normal T-Rex and Triceratops and those kind of things. But the one that I actually liked the most was an animal called Dimetrodon. And it's actually mildly ironic because Dimetrodon is not a dinosaur at all. In fact, it's one of those animals on the lineage that eventually led to mammals, which is what I work on today.
When my son was quite little, he absolutely became a dinosaur obsessive for about a good solid 2 years. And I was so pleased that he did that because I could follow him round and say, oh, it's my son, you know. But I was into it too. You never quite lose it, do you?
No, absolutely not. And that's one of the great things about paleontology that I find is that it is something that the general public want to hear more about.
Did you go looking for fossils when you were a kid?
Yeah, I did. So I was interested in both collecting rocks and collecting fossils. And the first fossils I found were actually up in the Murray River cliffs in inland South Australia, where the limestone there used to be part of a bigger inland sea. And it's just chock full of invertebrate fossils.
Yeah, what did you find there?
Well, there's one particular thing called an irregular echinoid. So it's like a sea urchin, but it doesn't have quite the same body shape as the round ones that we see around today. So it's sometimes known as a heart urchin. Yeah, picked up one of these, and that's the first fossil I can actually ever remember collecting.
I remember talking to Tim Flannery about his childhood on Port Phillip Bay in Melbourne and him finding his first fossils and the incredible everlasting thrill he got from that.
I think it's a pretty similar feeling every single time we find a new fossil. For me, certainly, it's never dimmed. And just the knowledge that quite often you're looking at something that's never been seen by a human before. It's an animal that might even be new to science. So, yeah, it's a pretty exciting thing.
And the vast interval between then and now?
Well, yeah, I guess depending on what you work on, that interval can be very large or relatively small. So being a paleontologist, we work on a geological timescale. So 100,000 years ago was practically yesterday to us when we've got fossils that go back billions of years. Although, in my biased opinion, I think that most of the interesting stuff happened in the last 40 or 50 million years because I work on fossil mammals. And in the case of Australia, a lot of the evolution of our modern fauna really started to take off when Australia separated from Antarctica somewhere between 35 and 40 million years ago.
So you went to Adelaide Uni. How were you brought into the world of the big beasts, Aaron?
Well, there's a lot of things in, I think, science careers in general that relate to serendipity. And in this particular case, my parents were actually on holiday without me, and they were down at Narracourt Caves, and they bumped into a man called Rod Wells. Now, Rod Wells is famous in South Australian paleontology. He was responsible for the co-founding of the main fossil chamber down at Narracourt and for having it listed as a World Heritage Site and for starting paleontology at Flinders University. And Rod mentioned to my parents that he was working on a dig on Kangaroo Island and that volunteers were welcome to come along. So that was all the encouragement I needed, and the rest is history.
What's there at Narracourt Caves? That's just near the Victorian border, isn't it? What's there that makes it such a great hunting ground for fossils?
So there are actually a whole series of caves that have fossils preserved down at Narracourt, and they span around about the last 500,000 years. And it's not just, you know, one spot here or one spot there. There are still a few gaps, but realistically, we can get a pretty good idea of what the faunas were doing throughout most of that period. So there's not really anywhere else in the world where we have that continuity looking at how different vertebrate communities have changed through the glacial and interglacial cycles.
Why are they there in a cave? Is that where they went for shelter, or was that a lair for some other animal that ate them, or what?
Well, there are actually a number of different accumulation mechanisms that can happen in caves. One of the very common ones is an owl roost. So quite often owls will go quite wide searching for their prey, but then they'll come back to one spot and they'll regurgitate a pellet that includes all of the bones and the fur from whatever they've or the feathers from whatever they've eaten. But then we've got other accumulation mechanisms. So if we've got a solution pipe, so this is kind of like a big chimney between the surface and the cave, well, that's the kind of thing that bigger animals can fall down into and then they're trapped in the cave.
Oh, yeah, that's true with all those caves around near the Nullarbor, isn't it? That's full of holes that animals just unwaringly fell into.
Yeah, and so they're what we call pitfall trap kind of caves, and they are fairly common, and that's the main mechanism through which larger vertebrates get trapped in caves.
So this star of Australian paleontology told your parents that you could go on a dig and go hunting for megafaunal remains. Where was this dig?
It's a place called Rocky River on the western side of Kangaroo Island, and it's a swamp today, and in fact it was probably a swamp when the megafauna were around as well, but not far below the surface at this swamp, there are literally thousands of bones of various different extinct megafaunal species. So I was only a few days into my dig and I was already working on excavating the teeth from Diprotodon, the largest marsupial that's ever lived.
So you found the skull of a Diprotodon?
Yeah, and in fact, there were many different bones from both Diprotodon and its relatives and a whole range of other extinct animals preserved in this swamp.
And what does it feel like slowly putting together a set of bones and skull fragments that are part of what this creature is and slowly figuring out what the animal is?
Well, I think the first thing that strikes you is the size of these animals. So Diprotodon was an animal that weighed about 2.5 tons, built a bit like a wombat, but probably about the size of your urban SUV. And so even just one tooth from that animal is much larger than anything you're likely to see in the animals that you're used to dealing with in modern day.
When you go into the golden age of Australia's megafauna, how far back are we going?
Well, we think the last of the megafauna disappeared about 40,000 years ago. So megafauna is a term that just means big animal. There's been a gradual trend over the last 5 million years in Australia, maybe even longer, for selecting for increased body size. And that peaks in the late Pleistocene period, which ended about 11,500 years ago.
Why do conditions favour increased body size? Is it just to keep the animal safe from predators?
Well, that's definitely one of the reasons. So the bigger an animal is, the bigger the predator needs to be, or unless the predators are hunting in packs. But there are a couple of other advantages as well. One of those is in order to keep warm, we need to eat lots of food. But the bigger we get, the more our surface-to-volume ratio changes so that we don't actually have to expend as much energy to keep ourselves warm.
Oh, you mean like big animals are more energy efficient then?
Yes, they are. So a little mouse will spend lots and lots of energy just keeping its body temperature up, whereas something the size of an elephant has the opposite problem. If it's not careful, it can get too warm.
What are the kind of limits on growth of an animal? Is it like the ability of the skeleton to support all that weight?
Yeah, exactly that. And that's, in fact, why we see that the biggest vertebrates that have ever evolved are the whales, because the sea can support body weight, which means there's not weight going on those bones. If we're looking at land animals, then it's a matter of how much weight that particular structure can support. But it's also partly dependent on the amount of biomass around. If there's not lots of food, then animals can't grow to large size either.
So we're talking about animals that existed up till around about, what, you say 50,000 years or so ago, going all the way back further to a million years and beyond that, there were giant marsupials. But were there giant birds and giant reptiles as well?
There absolutely were. So one of the famous members of the megafauna cohort in Australia is an animal called Geniornis, and it's a giant flightless bird. It's probably most closely related to ducks and geese, so it's not actually related to emus at all. It's a big, heavy bird, probably stood about 2.5, 2 metres tall, weighed about 250 kilograms.
And reptiles. Megalania, was that a reptile?
It sure was. It was a goanna, and in fact, it was about twice the size of a Komodo dragon. So it's the largest member of that group that's ever existed, and it seems to have been pretty widespread across Australia.
Was that an apex predator?
I bet it was. I don't think there'd be many things much bigger than it around. It was, and there's a bit of argument over exactly how large this animal was, because if we take a bone from Megalania and we assume it was built like a modern goanna, then it's going to be extremely long. But in fact, if we have a look at the morphology of those bones, they're showing us that it was a lot stouter. So it probably doesn't have the same kind of really long tail that we see in many of our goannas today. But either way, we're talking about an animal that was probably somewhere between 4 and 6 metres long.
And did it have a nasty bite on it too?
Yeah, well, that's one of the really interesting things. So some of the work that's been done by some of my colleagues up in Queensland has shown that there are grooves on the teeth that are similar to what we see in animals like Komodo dragons. And that's probably associated with the delivery of some kind of venom.
Why are those two things associated?
So the groove on the tooth is a delivery mechanism for that venom, similar to what we see in snakes, except in snakes it's often the interior part of the tooth that's delivering it.
So the tooth acts like a serrated edge knife or something, like a bread knife?
Yeah, so there's the cutting edge for the meat and then the kind of groove where the venom is going to be implanted after the cutting has happened.
So what did the interior of Australia look like for much of this time?
Yeah, so we have to remember that if we're going back 30 million years, say, Australia is right down much further south than it is today. And it's slowly been moving north over the last 35, 40 million years after it's separated from Antarctica. So it's been getting a little bit warmer as it moves north, but the global climate has been changing as well, and that's changed the amount of water that is available within these ecosystems. So if we go back 25 million years, then cool or temperate rainforest is relatively widespread across Australia.
But even in the centre, a rainforest at the centre?
Yeah, so we actually find fossils from particularly the pollen from trees like Nothofagus, the southern beech, which you can still see in parts of southern Victoria and Tasmania today. That's present in central Australia. It's also present, if we go back tens of millions of years, right throughout the supercontinent Gondwana. So it's one of those species that was right across Antarctica and South America and things as well.
And are there ice ages cycling throughout this period as well?
Yeah, so there have been at least 40 cycles between ice ages or glacial periods and interglacials, which are the periods of higher sea level that we're in today, across the Pleistocene in the last 2.5 million years. And for the last 500,000 years or so, they've been happening about every 120,000 years.
So we think humans now arrived in Australia across a land bridge from Asia sometime around about 55 or 60,000 years ago. That would have meant lower sea levels, when that would imply that there was some kind of an ice age or mini ice age going on at the time, I expect.
We don't actually see ice connecting up the different islands. So humans would have come down through Asia, through Indonesia, then maybe through New Guinea or maybe to northern Australia, like somewhere around Darwin or that kind of area. But even at the closest point, when the sea level's been lowest, they would have had to travel at least 50 kilometres across sea to get to the Australian landmass.
So the first Australians were mariners then?
Absolutely. Right. And in fact, the whole Pacific culture we see is a seagoing culture, and they were some of the finest navigators that we've ever seen. Imagine trying to get out in a pretty small boat to places like Vanuatu or Samoa or even out to Hawaii.
Was the Australia that they arrived in, given that you have rainforest that you're talking about, lusher and more crowded with animals when they got here?
Yeah, well, the rainforest definitely would have been contracting a lot by the time we get through to the time when humans have arrived. So the flora would be pretty similar to what we see today. But if we have a look in central Australia, we can see that places like Katitanda, Lake Eyre, would have been full of fresh water rather than the salt lakes that they are today. And this means that the vegetation that we see around those lakes would have been very, very different because there's so much more water around to support them.
Australia had been isolated for so long. What did that mean, that isolation, for how our animals evolved in that time?
Well, this is actually one of the reasons that I love working on Australian animals, because they have evolved in isolation for tens of millions of years. And further to that, we see that in Australia specifically, for whatever reason, the placental mammals never really got a foothold here until quite recently. So we think rodents arrived maybe 5 million years ago, but it's been the marsupials and the monotremes, so the pouched mammals and the monotremes of the echidnas and platypus, that have survived longer term and proliferated through the Australian continent. So it's got a very different makeup.
Right. And is that because there was a kind of a moat around Australia that stopped mammals coming in to compete with them?
No, not necessarily. So Australia was connected by land to Antarctica and Africa and Madagascar and India and South America when Gondwana was whole. And there were placental mammals on many of those other continents. So we don't actually understand the mechanism preventing placental mammals from getting to Australia.
But it's the reason why we have these distinctive, wild and crazy looking megafauna from way back when.
Absolutely. And we're very grateful for it.
So you did eventually your PhD on the Diprotodon family. And as we were saying, these look like giant wombats. And at some point, we do know that humans and Diprotodons coexisted in Australia. Can you imagine in your mind's eye what a human, presumably a terrified human, would have seen as a Diprotodon came lumbering towards a waterhole? How would you imagine that?
I imagine there would have been fear on both parts. So we've got people who have never seen these kinds of animals before perceiving them for the first time. But at the same time, we've got an Australian fauna that has evolved in isolation from any kind of primate. So this hairless human that's walking on two legs around is going to be something that they're not used to seeing. And that's also potentially going to lead to some naivety in terms of not perceiving it as a threat as well.
I wonder if they were territorial, like hippos are, because you're saying they were like the size of an SUV, which is roughly the size of a hippo. Do we know if they were territorial? Can you possibly determine such a thing from so far back in time?
Well, yeah, one of the great things that's being worked on at the moment and was actually pioneered by a paleontologist called Gilbert Price up in Queensland is looking at whether or not Diprotodon migrated. And we can do that by looking at strontium isotopes in its teeth. And because its front incisors were ever growing, they kept growing throughout its life, what that means is that different portions of the tooth reflect different periods of that animal's life. And if we see a cyclical pattern in the isotopes from those teeth, we can start to draw inferences about how that animal was moving about the landscape.
They were herbivores, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
But nonetheless, do we see any like Diprotodon teeth marks on animals as defensive measures or attacking measures? Do we know if they actually bit other creatures?
That is an excellent question. So one of the things that I like working on is the bite marks that are left behind. So this is the field called ichnology. It includes footprints, but also bite marks and understanding those kind of behavioural interactions. And I have not seen anything that I would confidently attribute to a Diprotodon, but in some of the conversations I've had with some of the Adnyamutna people from the Flinders Ranges, they have passed on to me stories that Diprotodon was capable of biting a man in half. Oh, so maybe there were some interactions there.
You mentioned their fossil footprints. How did you find your way to looking for these fossil footprints?
Well, Rod Wells co-supervised my PhD, and he was very passionate about giving me the opportunity to get out in the field to a range of the different sites that he'd worked on during his career. And one of those is a group of sites up in the Lake Eyre Basin. So there are two rivers today, the Warburton River and Cooper's Creek, that flow into Lake Eyre from the eastern side. And they're cutting their way down through older sediments. And as they cut their way down through those sediments, they erode fossils. So in 2006, I was out on the Warburton River with a group of people led by Rod, and we came across these lumps in the middle of the modern riverbed, and they were evenly spaced lumps. They're just like pedestals of hardened clay. They were trackways from one of the diprotodontids, a relative of Diprotodon from the Pliocene period, about 3.5 or 4 million years ago.
And what do those footprints look like?
Well, they're actually just pretty much oval blobs. So quite often when we see footprints, they don't necessarily preserve the fine texture of the skin or anything like that. It's the regular spacing that clues us in that we're looking at tracks that have been left by an animal rather than some random geological phenomenon.
Right, so it looks sort of stumpy, does it? But would they have had toes and claws?
That's an interesting thing about diprotodontids as well. The larger of the diprotodontids had reduced toes, particularly on the hind foot, and they bore most of their weight on their wrists and their ankles rather than on their digits. So most of the footprint was actually made up of the foot that was underneath the wrist and ankle rather than the digits themselves.
And are they moving in groups, you say? So they were herd animals of some kind?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that can potentially be inferred from footprints. So if we find lots of bones together, we don't know that they were all deposited at exactly the same time, so we don't necessarily have indications of herd behaviour. But what we found in those footprints on the Warburton River was 6 or 7 different individual trackways that were all fairly close together and all moving in the same direction. So that suggests that we've got a group of animals moving together rather than just one individual zigzagging back and forth or something.
So these footprints endure because, and I'm just guessing here, that diprotodons are marching through this area into the soft clay. They leave the impression in the clay. They leap, walk away from it. There's no rain for a while and the sun bakes it hard.
Yeah, so that's definitely the first step in the process. And then quite often those depressions will be infilled with more material. And in the case of what we saw on the Warburton, they were infilled with harder material. So the modern river has come down and it's actually washed away most of that clay from that period. But because the clay that infilled the footprints was harder, it's more resistant to weathering and it's been left behind.
Now, I know you have found footprints, fossil footprints, in sand dunes. How on earth do you find the footprint of a creature in sand dunes, Aaron?
It is hard to imagine how a footprint would survive in sand today. But if we have a look at the fossil sand dunes, so most of these sand dunes that we see along lots of the coast in southern Australia, from WA right over to Victoria, it builds up in small, thin layers. And if we have some salt spray or something blowing across those dunes and then it dries out, that can often be enough to just form a little crust on the dune before the next layer of sand then blows up and covers it.
Aaron, that just sounds like the most fragile, most evanescent thing that is throwing so much chance to fate that it could endure for hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, we spend most of our time moving around a landscape. So we're going to leave, if we're walking on softer substrate, millions of footprints across our lifetime. We only need a tiny percentage of them to survive to have some indication of the animals that were living in those areas.
What information do you get from the footprints of a giant animal that you don't get from a fossilized skeleton?
Well, the first thing is if it's very well preserved, then we may find that there are skin impressions, so that can tell us what the fleshed foot might have looked like, or at the very least, we might have the outline of the foot, which gives us a good idea of how big the foot was, where the weight was being distributed, those kinds of things. And then we can take a step back and we can look at the relationship between the prints themselves. So we might have prints that are quite widely spaced, and that means that an animal was kind of spread-eagled. So you think of something like a wombat today, they walk with their legs quite far apart, whereas something like a cow walks in with its legs right in underneath the body. So the spacing of the footprints can give us an idea about the posture of the animal. And then furthermore, if we know the animal that made the tracks and we know approximately how high its hip would have been. We can make calculations about how fast it was moving based on the spacing of those tracks.
And what did the Diprotodon footprints tell you about how fast that was moving?
Well, one of the things that you have to remember, have a think about how much of your life you spend running at top speed versus walking. So the vast majority of the footprints that we're going to see are going to be from an animal strolling about. So the calculations that we've made for the Diprotodon footprints suggest that they're probably moving around about 5 or 6 kilometres an hour, which is actually pretty standard for what we see for large herbivores.
The fact that you don't really find them running suggests that they really didn't have anything to run from?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. I think it really is a case of the vast majority of footprints representing the main activity that animals are doing. So there are some examples around the world of animals moving very fast. A famous example is Lark Quarry up in Queensland that was initially interpreted as a dinosaur stampede. But there are a whole bunch of small dinosaurs that are moving quite fast across the landscape there. But yeah, really, the chances of finding a hunt scene or an animal running are pretty low.
Podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Aaron, you went looking for tracks at a place called Lake Calabona. Where is Lake Calabona?
Today it's a salt lake. It's out east or northeast of the Flinders Ranges. So in South Australia, if we head a few hours north of Adelaide, we start getting into the Flinders, and out to the east we get out onto the plains, and Lake Calabona is one of a chain of lakes that are out there.
Where do you camp when you're digging out there?
Well, there's not much vegetation around there today, so what we tend to do is try and find one of the tributary creeks that's maybe got a couple of trees around, and we'll put our tents up. Then we've got to travel out to the fossil sites as well, because the places where the fossils are out on the lake, and they're in an area where we can't get even four-wheel drive vehicles out to, so we quite often use quad bikes or ATVs to be able to get out to these sites.
What does it look like when you're camped out there? What does that look and smell like, that place?
Oh, smell is an interesting way to describe it. There's definitely a bit of a fieldwork funk that develops after you've spent a few days a long way from any showers. So that would probably come to dominate the camp smells. But there's a lot of salt around and a lot of very dry sediment as well. And it's very difficult to describe that smell, but it definitely gets all through your clothes, and it has a particular thing that we often associate with places that we go in the field.
Is it so empty you can hardly hear a thing out there?
I would argue it's so empty that you can hear anything very well if it does make a noise. I mean, even in these really, really arid, barren areas, we still see bird life. I can't remember a field site I've been to where I haven't seen a willy wagtail around. They seem to be able to get just about anywhere.
What did Lake Calabona look like at the time of megafauna? I'm picturing a big waterhole surrounded by Diprotodons and big kangaroos instead of lions and zebras and elephants. Was it like that?
Yeah. Well, part of it is obviously just going to be up to our imagination, because we don't know all of the details. But the first thing is, when we say Lake Calabona, it's not one big round lake. It's a whole series of interconnected pans that span more than 20 kilometres. And so some of those might have had varying degrees of water in them. Some of them might have been relatively shallow, others deeper. But what we can see from the hydrological record of the last 100,000 years is that places like Lake Eyre and Lake Frome appeared to have had permanent water in them up until about 48,000 years ago. So this would have meant that you've got much more biomass in terms of the plants. And it's not necessarily that we've got different species. So we've got things like she-oaks and acacias, so wattles, and some eucalypts and myoporums and hakeas and things. But rather than being tiny little stunted bushes, because they've got more water available, they're much larger, there's more of them, and that's going to support lots of animals too.
Was that that you found the tracks of a gigantic kangaroo, the striding kangaroo as it's called, Procoptodon goliath, and goliath presumably refers to its goliath-like size. How big are we talking about here for this giant kangaroo?
Well, there's been a bit of argument over exactly how tall it could stand because it's a very large kangaroo, but the short-faced kangaroos or the Stenyarine kangaroos, which is the group that Procoptodon belongs to, actually probably had more of a hunched-over posture. So it's maybe 2 metres tall when it's standing up, but it's got a different shoulder to our modern kangaroos, which meant that it could have reached up and pulled down branches. So when it's reaching up, it might have a reach of another half a metre or so. So it's maybe reaching up 2.5 metres to pull down its food.
Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine at the moment at that size, it would be taking up most of the space in this tiny studio I'm in right now. It's just as well it's not here. What was so distinctive about the tracks you found of this giant kangaroo?
Well, I think anybody in the world today, they hear about a kangaroo and they instantly picture an animal that's going to be jumping across the landscape. And one of the things about the Stenyarine or the short-faced kangaroos is that they were very large in body size. So Procoptodon was probably somewhere between 200 and 250 kilograms, so a very robust kangaroo. And this means when they get to that size that there are some biomechanical challenges around jumping.
You mean they'd fall to pieces if they tried? They'd snap bones and tissue and what have you?
Well, it puts a lot of stress particularly on their Achilles tendon, because that's where the energy gets stored when they're jumping. And it can get to a point that there's a point where body mass is going to get so high that that's potentially going to fail and tear.
Right. So we have to try and imagine something like a horse jumping around the environment, in other words. Well, they can hop and leap a bit, but not for too long.
Yeah, exactly. And so Christine Janis actually came up with a theory about 10 years ago now that these short-faced kangaroos were potentially striding like we do rather than jumping around. And that was a prediction made from the skeletal morphology. So it's a pretty amazing insight into what they might be doing. And it's not actually until last year that we were out at Lake Calabona and we found tracks from the same time period that Procoptodon was around that appear to be of a kangaroo that is bipedally striding.
So it's just walking on those pads, those little padded feet?
Yeah. So if you have a really close look at kangaroo feet today, they have two toes that hold up most of the weight, whereas the short-faced Stenyarine kangaroos only had one toe that was bearing most of that weight. So the foot impression that's left behind is kind of like a long oval with a claw impression at the front.
So that means if they're striding and not hopping, we'd have to assume they're moving much more slowly than a kangaroo.
Yeah, absolutely. And that means that they're putting less pressure on their joints as well. And if we have a look at the trackways, the footprints are very widely spaced. So that indicates an animal that's kind of doing a low kind of waddling walk rather than right up on the tips of its toes and nimbly running along.
When you're finding the remains of megafauna out at Lake Calabona, why is that such a good space, a good place for finding such remains?
We don't actually know why Lake Calabona has the deposit it has, but maybe it was just that the climate was right, there were megafauna around, there was water around, all coming in at the right time. But what we do see is that literally thousands of megafaunal skeletons are stuck in the mud, are preserved in the mud at Lake Calabona. And in some instances, we can still see the feet or the lower legs vertical where that animal was mired in the mud when it first entered into the lake.
So if you're looking at a fast-forward video of that process, of the animal getting stuck, of like this giant kangaroo, for example, being stuck in the mud, what do we imagine here? We imagine it's stuck, it can't get out. Eventually it collapses into the mud. And what does the mud do for it after that?
Well, getting buried, even though it sounds horrible if you're still alive, slowly sinking into the mud, is actually great for paleontologists because it means that you're partway towards becoming a fossil already. because the burial process is crucial to the preservation of the bones. But in the case of Lake Calabona, because it happens so quickly, we get another phenomenon coming in, which is that you can get concretions that are made by bacteria forming around joints as the bacteria are decaying the soft tissue. And those concretions can form within a few weeks or months of the animal's death, and they can potentially preserve soft tissue impressions that otherwise would rot away.
Ooh, so what kind of soft tissue? Are we talking about skin, fur?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the case of Diprotodon, we've found skin impressions underneath the feet, and we've also found hair impressions around the limbs and around the belly. And in the case of Geniornis, the big flightless bird, we found feather impressions and impressions from the scales on its lower leg.
Oh, have they retained any colour?
No. So unfortunately, that's something that doesn't preserve in the fossil record. In the case of birds, if the feather itself, if the physical structure of the feather preserves, then the shape of the tiny, tiny little components that make up that feather can give us a clue as to the colour. But in Calabona, unfortunately, we've just got voids where the impression of the fur or the feathers have been left behind rather than the soft tissue fossilising itself.
And are you digging for these fossils, or are they just naturally finding their way to the surface?
Well, what we do is we will survey a large area, and to date we've found over 500 individual skeletons, most of which are Diprotodon. And we've been trying to sort of target some of the rarer animals because we know a reasonable amount about Diprotodon at the moment. But sometimes we'll just see the foot bones, so the pretty much the whole skeleton will have eroded away. Sometimes we'll just see the tips of the vertebrae, and that's really what we're looking for, because that means that the modern erosional surface has just started to come down on the top of that skeleton, so we're more likely to have a complete or relatively complete skeleton.
Oh, and the tissue, wouldn't that have to be under the mud? Because
yes,
the mud keeps the oxygen out, doesn't it?
Yeah, so what we think's happened is that as these animals have been walking out across the lake's surface, they've broken through a crust, and there's this beautiful blue clay below that crust, which even today when it's wet can get really, really sloppy. So we still see animals like camels that get bogged in Lake Calabona today. So if they've broken through that crust, then they sink into the mud.
But if you're pulling up remains that have had tissue on them and that have remained oxygen-free under the surface for tens of thousands, maybe millions of years, is there a bit of a race there against time before the outside air just destroys, rots that tissue?
Yeah, absolutely. So we see, I mean, so the tissue itself is not preserved, it's the impression. So they're impressed on rock or relatively consolidated soil or sediments. But the modern erosional system, so the water, the wind, the salt that's blowing over the surface, absolutely breaks down anything that is exposed on the surface. So there is a relatively narrow window of time between when a skeleton is first exposed and when it weathers through to the point where we're no longer going to have a useful skeleton left behind.
Watching that ABC TV series on megafauna that you're part of, Aaron, the beast that really is quite mesmerising is the Thylacoceo, the so-called marsupial lion. Where have you found that in the past?
So Thylacoleo is essentially the mammalian apex predator for these Australian ecosystems. And unlike some of the other parts of the world that have sort of distinct areas where they've got a whole predator guild, Thylacoleo seems to have been the top mammal predator right across Australia and down into Tasmania as well.
Not just in grassy savannas like the African lion.
No, in fact, it's quite common in wooded environments too.
Oh, it's like a puma then as well.
Yeah, well, some of the work that Rod did on it or has done on it over the last 40 years has suggested that maybe it filled a leopard-like niche. So it's a climbing animal, and maybe it even was able to pull its prey up into trees as well to stop other predators getting at it.
How much of this creature have you been able to reconstruct?
Fortunately, there are some excellent fossils of Thylacoleo, both from caves down in the Narracourt region and in the Nullarbor region, that have allowed us to look at just about every single part of its anatomy.
One of its most outstanding features are the teeth of this Thylacoleo. What do they look like?
Well, they're really interesting because the family that Thylacoleo belongs to have evolved from, we think, herbivorous ancestors. And that's unusual. Usually a carnivore is going to have big canines associated with grabbing its prey, but the ancestors of the Thylacoleonids didn't have large canines. And so instead we see that in Thylacoleo, its incisors, those pointy teeth at the front, are quite large, not necessarily for piercing and grabbing prey. We're not really sure exactly how that happened, but then instead of having a row of molars and premolars like we have in our cheeks, it's got essentially one big tooth that's pushed out all the others. It's a long blade-like premolar. And when it comes down, the top and bottom tooth come down together. They act like a pair of secateurs for cutting through flesh and bone.
Oh, God. You said it seems to have evolved quite recently, relatively speaking, from its plant-eating predecessors. Why did it even start eating meat in the first place? Do we have any idea?
So we've got a relatively long lineage of members within the family Thylacoleonidae that go back about 25 million years. The earliest ones were very small. They were sort of cat-sized, probably running around in trees. And we don't really know why that particular group evolved into its carnivorous niche. But certainly by the time we get to the Pleistocene period, when we've got giant herbivores wandering around, there is almost a need in terms of ecosystem function for there to be large predators to keep control of those herbivore populations. So there's an open space for animals like Thylacoleo to evolve into.
So what kind of meat are they eating then? Are they eating Diprotodon?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. We've got a study we're working on at the moment where we've surveyed fossils from Victoria, from New South Wales, from South Australia, about 18,000 in total, specifically looking for Thylacoleo bite marks on bones. And it had been assumed previously that Thylacoleo really was a big game specialist. It was going after Diprotodons or its relative Zygomaturus or some of the really big kangaroos. But what we've actually found on the bite-marked bones is that it appears to have been a kangaroo specialist, so not so much on the Diprotodon end of the spectrum.
So they're more opportunistic then. They're going for smaller but faster-moving prey.
Yeah, so they're still, big animals. If you think about a big red kangaroo today, they can be 80 or 90 kilos, and Thylacoleo appears to have been going for the group of what we call long-faced or macropodine kangaroos that includes those that are still around today. But the key point about where we find the bite marks is that they're on the ankles. Now, the ankles don't have much meat on them, so it's unlikely to be a feeding strategy. So the other idea is that it's probably a hunting strategy. So the Thylacoleo is chomping on the ankle to incapacitate these animals so that they can't hop away.
So we imagine then it's racing after them. It's racing after a fleeing kangaroo, chomping down on the leg to incapacitate it, then it can eat it at its leisure.
Yeah, but it's going to be an ambush predator. So it's not going to be pursuing them like a dog over, tens of kilometres. It's going to be hiding in the shrubbery or potentially even hiding up a tree, waiting for the opportunity to strike and then knocking over the kangaroo, maybe while it's at a waterhole or something like that, and then chomping down on that leg.
What you're describing sounds a bit like a drop bear. You are aware of this, Aaron?
Well, absolutely. We really do have the original drop bear right here.
Does it make sense in any way to call it a kind of a cat? I know it's a marsupial and it's not a mammal, but it sounds like it's roughly the size of, a leopard or something like that. It's covered in fur. Is it cat-like in its movement?
Not really. In fact, what we've learnt from studying things like its vertebral column is that it probably moved more like a Tasmanian devil, so relatively stiff-backed, not necessarily sort of crouched really low in the grass. In fact, the whole term Thylacoleo means pouched lion, and it is part of a wider issue that we have that the Australian fauna are very different to anything else that we've seen in the fossil record. And so we have to draw on animals that we're familiar with to try and describe a bit what they were like. And as an apex predator and a meat eater, the idea was that Thylacoleo was filling the same kind of niche that lions fill in Africa. So it's not that it actually looks like a lion, it's that it's filling the same kind of role in the ecosystem.
Describe this clawed thumb it has. Yeah.
So if we have a look at the hand of Thylacoleo, it's got 5 digits like our hand does, but the thumb is much larger than the other 4 digits. And like us, it appears to have been opposable, so it could move around in the opposite direction to the other 4 fingers or digits, and it's got a great big claw on the end of it. So when we see the fossilized parts of claws, we only get the bony core of them. We don't get the keratinous sheath, so that's the same thing that our fingernails are made of. So the claw itself may well have been 8 or 10 centimeters long, but the bit that preserves is maybe only 4 or 5 centimeters.
So this means they can grab.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually a key difference between Thylacoleo and all of our placental carnivores. It doesn't matter if you're looking at the canids, the wolves and dogs and things, or if you're looking at ursids, bears, or our felines, our cats. They've all got hands that have claws but don't have a grasping ability associated with an opposable digit.
And these wounds you've found on kangaroo bones, are some of those from this claw, or are they pretty much entirely from the mouth?
No, we think they're all from the tooth. So enamel, the mineral that teeth are made of, is much harder than keratin, which is what our fingernails are made of. And it's probably likely that the claws of Thylacoleo were not hard enough to leave significant marks on bone, certainly hard enough that they could have grabbed onto flesh or even pierced flesh, but probably not leaving the marks on the bones.
Oh, God. In terms of imagining grisly deaths at the hands of one of these creatures, this sounds like a creature that could tear another animal to pieces. It would be worse than a shark attack in some ways.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, because one of the things about predators is that they don't want to risk damage any more than they absolutely have to. So if we look at like a Komodo dragon today, and probably what Megalania was doing as well, is they might bite an animal, and because they've got that venom and the bacteria associated with that that's going to cause the wound to putrefy over several days, they can just afford to follow that animal around until it eventually carks it. And maybe in the case of Thylacoleo, it can get 1 or 2 quick bites in, or maybe some damage with its thumb claws, and then back off and wait for that animal to die rather than rending it limb from limb.
Now, we know, as you say, these megafauna start to disappear from the fossil record round about the same time that humans arrived in Australia. It sort of neatly sort of coincides. And we do know that humans were responsible for the death of megafauna in other parts of the world where they've been overhunted. But why is it hard to say for certain? Or why are paleontologists reluctant to say for certain that humans played a decisive role in the extinction of megafauna here?
If we have a look at the global record, we can see that in almost all cases, the megafauna have gone extinct after humans have arrived on a given continent. So this is similar kind of pattern in the Americas, in New Zealand, in Australia. And what we don't have necessarily is direct evidence of how those extinctions took place or the main factors. So we have to think about what things were changing in the environment that could have caused it. So was there a significant change in climate? And did that have a big impact on these animals? And then when it comes to human arrival, in the case of Australia, the questions can be things like, well, we know that they have burned the landscape in times past, and many of our First Nations people continue to carry out that practice today. Did that have an effect on vegetation patterns and the megafauna that were reliant on the vegetation? Or were humans taking advantage of these big, slow-moving protein sources roving around and hunting them directly? But the problem is that in an Australian context, we have no direct evidence for hunting of the megafauna, and we don't really have any direct evidence that climate was the thing that killed the megafauna either. So if we're going to be careful in our science, it then becomes much harder to say if there was any distinct factor involved.
When we talk about history, and people often ask the question, why did the Roman Empire fall, or the ancient Western Roman Empire fall? You know, Edward Gibbon back in the day said, well, it was because they got effete, they became Christianized, they lost their kind of military hardness, they became addicted to luxury, and they became decadent. But But, of course, now we know, and increasingly, this is only in recent years, we find out all these environmental factors came into play in the ending of the Roman Empire, over which took place over several centuries. I suppose it's a similar thing here too. There are all sorts of complex environmental factors in play, of which human agency might be one of them, but it's the answer, I suppose, is likely to be very complex.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we have to remember about megafauna is that the bigger an animal is, the longer it takes, usually, to grow to its adult size. So if we've got a fluctuating climate where there might be periods of drought and then periods of water and plentiful food, then those periods of drought are going to affect the larger, slower breeding animals more than they're going to affect the smaller, faster breeding animals. So if we've got a population that might have been knocked around a bit by drought already, then other factors coming in, such as landscape modification or hunting, might be the thing that pushes that population over the edge.
There has long been talk of using cloning technology to bring a thylacine back from the dead. But after talking to you, Aaron, I want a full-blown thylacoleo, please, ideally a couple of them. How do you feel about that sort of science when it comes to megafauna?
Well, I don't think there's a single paleontologist alive who wouldn't like to see what their study organism looked like when it was still moving around. But if we're going to be realistic about our landscapes today, we're currently at a stage where we haven't actually demonstrated that we can look after the ecosystems that are still around, or that that is even a priority. And so the question then becomes, well, how can we spend money and resources on bringing something back that's already extinct if we can't even demonstrate that we can maintain an ecosystem for it to live in?
Well, we're still mourning over the death of the last thylacine. What was it, in the 1930s or something? Imagine how it would be if we invested all this technology and effort to bringing a thylacine back and then it died again.
Exactly. So I think the first step there is really to show that we have the passion and the ability to look after what we've got, to stabilize our environments, to conserve areas where our unique fauna can continue to survive, and then there might be a place in those ecosystems for something like the thylacine.
Aaron, it's been lovely speaking with you. Thank you for taking us back into that ancient, ancient world.
Thanks very much for having me, Richard.
Today's program was made on Gadigal, Turrbal and Jagera lands. It was produced by Meggie Morris. Our executive producer is Carmel Rooney. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.